It was supposed to be a call to action, not a victory lap, according to President Obama's aides. How did the president's farewell speech from Chicago sit with you? Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for the Joy Cardine Show. Our guest this hour studies the speeches of presidents, past and present, from his post at the University of Illinois. Political science professor Brian Gaines has appointments in the Department of Political Science and at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Brian, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, President Obama delivered his farewell speech last night from Chicago, calling it the honor of his life to serve. Here's the president.
It has been the honor of my life to serve you. I won't stop. In fact, I will be right there with you as a citizen for all my remaining days. But for now, whether you are young or whether you're young at heart, I do have one final ask of you as your president. The same thing I asked when you took a chance on me 8 years ago. I'm asking you to believe, not in my ability to bring about change, but in yours.
So what were your immediate takeaways, Brian?
Well, I think it would be fair to say it was both a call to action and a victory lap. He scheduled to talk in his hometown in front of a very large crowd rather than delivering a subdued address from the Oval Office or from, contrasted with recent predecessors, George H.W. Bush went to West Point and had a smaller and not necessarily as friendly audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he planned it to, in such a way that it had the feel of a campaign event, but it was at least as much future oriented as it was to ticking off boxes about what he's achieved. I think it's safe to say he did both, and I think that quotation you just played is a good one, because the "I won't stop" language is probably one people will be discussing, arguing about over the water cooler today and in weeks to come. Exactly how much does he plan to make himself into something like a leader of the opposition as President Trump takes office? And to what degree will he follow the more traditional presidential path of receding into the background for a little while at least? And it's anyone's guess. I think the speech maybe suggests he's not going to take George W. Bush's route. And George W. Bush, I think I had the impression he really was tired of the spotlight and wanted out of it, and didn't spend much time at all contradicting criticism of his administration in the early days of the Obama years. So Dick Cheney did a little bit of that. Bush was pretty silent. I think Obama probably won't be as silent as Bush.
Yeah, it sounds like there was a bit of fire in his belly, so to speak. Would you consider this a signature hope and change speech then for the president?
Well, you know, I think the whole speech had to tiptoe an interesting line. It's not there's nothing so inherently contradictory in saying we've achieved a lot, but there's a lot more to be done. But he likes to make very grand claims, and so he opened by saying the country's never been freer, it's better in every way than it was when I took office, and then the next few minutes pass, and he's describing the enormous challenges, the four great threats to democracy, the polarization of the nation, the failure to achieve a post-racial nation. You blink and think a moment ago everything was great, and now he's describing seems like nothing but serious problems. And how do you square the two? He's very articulate, and I think he's quite good at making that kind of shift. But I think if you sit down and look at the speech on paper, it is a little bit striking that there are these two themes that are at least in some tension. That if those 8 years were so successful, and we've achieved so much, and his administration has been so has succeeded on all these fronts, why are the problems so dire?
Well, President Obama identified what he views as threats, as you mentioned, to democracy, including this clip we'd like to listen to about race.
After my election, there was talk of a post-racial America. And such a vision, however well-intended, was never realistic. Race remains a potent and often divisive force in our society. Now, I've lived long enough to know that race relations are better than they were 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, no matter what some folks say. You can see it not just in statistics. You see it in the attitudes of young Americans across the political spectrum. but we're not where we need to be.
How would you explain how Obama worked his way around the issue of race in the speech?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't want to try to explain how he worked his way around. He made it relatively prominent, and again, in this case, rather than initially claiming we've made great strides, there's a lot more work to be done, he left off the first part and said it was crazy ever to think just because the country had a non-white president that racial problems were behind us. I don't know that many people thought that. I think a lot of people might disagree that race relations are better than they were 10 years ago. He said 10, 20, 30 years ago. Think back 10 years ago. My sense is a lot of people have the impression that they've deteriorated. And 10 is an interesting number because it includes his term and George W. Bush's. It's not just a question of which president oversaw it. But I don't think many people would disagree that the racial relationship across races are bad now. And I think part of what we just saw in the last election was the even more polarized voting across races, but in a way that a lot of people hadn't anticipated. I think for those who'd been saying the Republican Party is doomed because racial minorities will continue to vote Democratic and the white voters will stay where they were, hadn't anticipated that white voters can shift as well. And the next thing you know, you can have a Republican victory, even as it's still true that most of the non-white voters are disproportionately Democratic.
We're dissecting President Obama's farewell address we heard last night from Chicago with our guest, political scientist Brian Gaines from the University of Illinois. We'd like to bring in your voice to this conversation and 1-800-642-1234. Did you learn something about the 44th president's legacy? How did the tone and message strike you? Add your voice at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So lots to discuss. You mentioned victory lap. Before the speech, White House officials previewed that this speech would be more of a call to action than a victory lap. Why do you think he went this route?
Well, a second-term president can't run again. He has to think inevitably about his legacy. I think he's taking a stab at sort of launching the definition. How should he be assessed? He ticked off some of his successes at the beginning of the speech. He mentioned Cuba. I don't know that that's really going to be regarded as a big part of his legacy. Changes in relationship with Cuba were late in his term, and in fact, the Cuban government hasn't really changed at all. So I think whatever happens in Cuba in the next 10 years, historians are probably not going to say that Barack Obama's actions were critical. But he mentioned Iran, and I think that's a more obvious one where he wants, at this point, we don't know exactly what's going to happen in the near future. President Trump is likely to make pretty abrupt changes in policy on a lot of fronts. Probably Iran is one of them. I think Barack Obama wants to cement the notion that he has achieved a good deal that makes the world safer, and if it gets screwed up, it's not his fault. So the mix of advising people what problems the country faces and what they should do to fix them, but also reminding them what he thinks he's done well is partly a matter of getting getting his hand in on defining his legacy and telling people what he thinks he should be remembered for as having succeeded.
Let's take another listen here to a portion of the speech talking about some of the things Obama celebrated.
If you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life. If something needs fixing, then lace up your shoes and do some organizing. If you're disappointed by your elected officials, grab a clipboard, get some signatures, and run for office yourself.
So a battle cry there, how effective was it?
You know, the very first point there struck me as a funny one because he had already been talking about the bubble. The academics are obsessed these days with polarization and how the technology has allowed us to talk only with people we agree with so that we don't have to argue with strangers on the internet. And to say, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, argue with them in real life. I mean, part of the point is don't just engage in virtual discussion. Go out there and talk to real people. This has been something sociologists have been speculating about for a long time. What's the change? And if you're sitting around chatting with the guys and you're bowling as you bowl about what's going on in your city, and they're a mix of people from across the income spectrum, that's a different kind of engagement from talking to your Facebook friends. But it was another odd juxtaposition that, having already discussed this idea that we live in bubbles, he threw out the idea that we're arguing the internet. If you're tired of that, get back to real world engagement.
We're talking with Brian Gaines. He's a political scientist from the University of Illinois. We want to hear from you. Did President Obama's speech strike a chord with you? Did you learn something you didn't know about the presidency? How did the tone and message strike you? 800-642-1234 or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Back after this news. It's 9 days now before President-elect Trump takes office, and we're closing the books on President Obama's farewell speech and what messages he had from his final public address in office. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Joy Cardine. His aides say the speech could contain a mix of reflection and advice for the future. Is that what you heard? What stuck out to you in last night's speech? What do you think is President Obama's legacy? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Staying with us is political science professor Brian Gaines from the University of Illinois, who studies the speeches of presidents. Let's go now to the phones with Tess from Woodbury, Minnesota. Hi, Tess.
Hi, yes. Thank you for having me. President Obama's speeches last night, I'm very impressed. Because every time he expressed about situation, he is more try to inform people than neglect people. So he communicates very well. As far as his legacy, for 8 years, he received from Bush to war, economic crisis. So he got up from this economic crisis, from this war, into this situation. Everybody's working now. Everybody's making money. So he did a lot. I can go on, but to make things short, I'm very happy for what he did. So that's all I have to say.
So very pleased with the economy there, Tess from Woodbury, Minnesota. Brian?
Yeah, so I think this is one of those points where you'll get a starkly different appraisal from Republicans and Democrats. Obama did cite some decent economic statistics at the beginning of the speech to stress, I think, exactly the way the caller phrased it. He inherited the mess and he fixed it. Republicans who are doubtful about that will say, forget about unemployment, look at employment. The employment rate is down because a lot of people gave up looking for jobs. The employment numbers are less impressive, and that the recovery would have been a lot better without various policies, and they'll probably point the fingers prominently at Obamacare.
Well, let's take another caller now, Kenneth from Shattuck. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I just watched it last night, and I thought Obama did a good job of running the country. I think in a few years we'll look back and we'll wish we had someone with the common sense he had. When it was over with, I turned it on Fox News to see if I could get a laugh or to see what they had to say about it. And Hannity was on, and he says, the Obama nightmare is over.
Yeah, so you got certainly a different perception when you listened to, when you've tuned into another type of media for the takeaways from the speech.
Well, there's no wonder why the country is so split. There's a difference between night and day, between one news outlet and the other. And most people do turn on what they want to hear.
Brian Gaines, turning on what you want to hear, taking away from the speech what it is you want, how would you broach that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that was one of the themes of the speech, and I think most people would agree with the president, whether you celebrate or lament the fact that it's true that the people can choose to live in a bubble to an unprecedented degree, that if you want to hear only left or right-wing news, it's not that hard to do it. There are more news sources, which is a good thing, but then people can select into them. And I think that's true. What Obama said last night will have given his fans lots of ammunition to say he really has done a great job, and we're sure going to miss his articulate delivery. And his opponents will, searching for talking points, will find no shortage of critics saying this guy is deluded thinking he's succeeded in any of these ways. Here's all the ways he failed. And it's hard to find something in between, the kind of balanced perspective that of someone truly disinterested who isn't cut an elephant or a donkey tattooed to his chest.
Well, let's talk a little bit about rhetoric. At one point, Obama seemed to defend American democracy and values, saying, quote, democracy can buckle when it gives into fear. So just as we as citizens must remain vigilant against external aggression, we must guard against a weakening of the values that make us who we are. What was he talking about, and is this unusual content for a farewell speech?
Well, yeah, I think it was one of the ways he was maybe trying to elevate it beyond a final campaign theme speech. He did follow this theme of the threats to democracy. I lost track late in the speech and whether it was four threats. He was using the word threat again, but I think he never, unless I missed it, I think he said there was a fourth threat. But one of them was this, should we lose our values? He used that turn of phrase, which has been a very popular one for him throughout his presidency, this, it's not who we are as Americans. And, you know, I think there was one of the key times when the shadow of Donald Trump was quite visible. He was he seemed to have in mind some of the Trump rhetoric, maybe particularly that against linking Muslims to terrorism. And he got one of his loudest applauses when he said that there's no room for discrimination of any kind against, including against Muslims. So, you know, the notion that we shouldn't lose sight of our values going forward, this is one of the most important things about democracy. You have to remember what it means to be a Democrat. That was some of his loftiest rhetoric. But I think, again, a critic would think that this is coming from someone who's it hasn't been short of sort of fiery partisan rhetoric when it suits him, that he doesn't hesitate to vilify his opponents. Now he can say at the end of his presidency that you have to realize sometimes your opponents have a good point, but when he was sort of engaged in policy debates, he tended to say, well, I won the election, so I make the call. But in any case, I do think he was that's one case where the sort of bigger theme of what is it that's wrong with democracy today was something he was hoping to get in there that went beyond what policy achievements does he have and what's ahead with this new president.
We're exploring takeaways from President Obama's speech from Chicago last night with Brian Gaines, a political science professor at the University of Illinois. Let's bring in more voices to this conversation and hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Was President Obama's speech a call to action for you? Are you motivated to become more engaged and more active in your community or in politics? How did you feel about this speech? When did you applaud? When did you tune out? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. One of our Facebook posts here from Kenneth in Janesville says he felt that comparing the old and the young and dismissing the old, saying that senior citizens were left out of this speech. And we want to take this back now to young people, because President Obama did address young people at specific points in the speech. Let's take a listen to this next generation.
Let me tell you, this generation coming up, unselfish, altruistic, creative, patriotic, I've seen you in every corner of the country. You believe in a fair and just and inclusive America. You know that constant change has been America's hallmark, that it's not something to fear, but something to embrace. You are willing to carry this hard work of democracy forward. You'll soon outnumber all of us, and I believe as a result, the future is in good hands.
Invigorating message for young people. What do you make of this message?
Well, on the campaign trail, it's very hard for a politician not to keep in mind that turnout rates for people over 60 greatly exceed those for under 30. And if you flatter the young, you probably want to quickly follow up by saying nice things about the people who are more likely to vote. But Obama's not after votes at the moment. So someone who's, again, thinking about his legacy and trying to cement his a particular view of his achievements, it makes perfect sense to throw a few Valentines towards the young, the people who are going to be here longest. I thought maybe the funny thing about his country, he didn't say a great deal about older Americans. The one time he mentioned maybe it was a middle-aged white guy who seems to have advantages, but the world's passing him by. Technology is robbing him his economic opportunities. We have to understand him. That didn't sound terribly understanding. That sounded a little bit to me like his infamous description of rural white voters who are bitter and clinging to religion and guns. But it was an effort, I guess, to sort of speak on to both sides, people who, you know, this was in his, you have to understand the other people unlike yourself. And so he didn't want to say only that white Americans need to understand the difficulties of being in the minority. And he made a stab at least at saying what people who are, you know, in a word, the Trump voters look like, what are they thinking?
And how did President Obama address Trump, President-elect Trump? Were you surprised that he didn't criticize the president-elect openly?
No, I think that probably would have been a mistake. I don't know. I haven't seen this morning whether Trump has tweeted. He seems to be, it seems likely to me that he can't seem to stop himself from tweeting. But the nature of being the giving your final address as a president is that events are going to supersede you, and Trump was going to be in the spotlight soon, inevitably, some of the ways people think about Obama would be based on the contrast with his successor. So he didn't need to sort of open a debate explicitly. I think, again, a couple of times in the speech, it was clear he had Trump in mind when he was discussing policies he particularly dislikes, and the idea that that fighting terrorism means treating Muslim Americans as different. I mean, again, that I think was the one moment where he didn't have to use Trump's name. No, I didn't really expect him to come out saying, with offering a bunch of criticisms of Trump before he's even taken the office.
And President-elect Trump seems poised to try to do away with a number of President Obama's initiatives, achievements, including the Affordable Care Act. What does that mean for Obama's legacy?
Yeah, I think ultimately, this right now it's very hard not to have the very short-term view, sort of thinking week to week, but in the long run, the domestic and foreign sides of his legacy are probably going to be defined chiefly by Obamacare and on the domestic side, and then some mix of how is the Middle East and how safe is the world. So on the former, I think Obamacare is in big trouble, but nobody has an entirely clear, it's not like there's a very clear roadmap that those who want to repeal Obamacare have agreed on. If you sort of Google repeal Obamacare, you can find no shortage of plans, and there's lots of detail from various people in Congress, from think tanks, the Cato Institute, the Hoover Institution. You can find no shortage of ideas, but it's not like we really have a very clear sense of what repeal is going to look like yet. Trump, with a Republican majorities in both chambers, is certainly going to make changes quickly. How quickly the Senate can move is always a hard call. But I think Obama, again, is going to be, his defenders may be in a position of saying he got health care on the right track, and then unfortunately it was derailed by his successor. On the international front, I think he's on weaker ground. His legacy, if it's tied to keeping Iran from developing nuclear weapons, looks very shaky. And he made a critical tactical decision not to make this Iran deal a treaty. He didn't want to have to get Senate approval. He didn't think he could get it. But that does mean it's going to be even easier for Trump to change course quickly. So now I think those are sort of the two pillars of his legacy, and we don't really know what either will look like. But I think it's fair to say that it's pretty likely that there will be big changes in both fronts, and that's going to sort of cloud the idea that he made lasting changes for the benefit of the whole country.
We're combing through President Obama's farewell address we heard last night from Chicago with our guest, political scientist Brian Gaines from the University of Illinois. Many farewell speeches going all the way back to George Washington come with wise words and warnings. And what did you hear in this speech that struck you? Add your voice to the conversation at 800-642-1234. How did the tone and message strike you? You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or give us a call at 800-642-1234. And so there was some nostalgia during which we thanked his family. He thanked his family, Vice President Joe Biden and other staff. His tone seemed to change during this period. Brian, talk a little bit about the lighter moments of the speech.
Yeah, well, the presidential families are almost always more popular than presidents. The American people have to sympathize, especially with children, with adolescents stuck in the spotlight. They certainly didn't want, because their father has always been father so far, not yet mother or grandmother, as it might have been. Took the highest office, and I think there's lots of sympathy for spouses and children, and I think that the crowd has greatly enjoyed the chance to applaud Michelle Obama and to hear Obama praising his daughters. His daughters have an interesting role again, because his younger daughter is only a sophomore in high school. I think he's planning to stay in Washington D.C.,
mm-hmm.
not move straight to Chicago as he might have throw himself into the work of building up the Obama library, maybe writing presidential memoirs. Being in D.C. might just be another thing that makes it irresistible for him to be taking part in public debate. As we see what happens with Obamacare, last night he said he'd welcome any changes in healthcare that result in more Americans being insured at less cost. But if he's seeing what he regarded as the most important legislation, and clearly he did, set tax reform and other possible priorities aside to work on health care. He's seeing that being unwound. It might be hard for him not to be weighing in and basically, as I mentioned before, acting as though, in some respects, he's the leader of the opposition in a parliamentary sense, although he's, as a former president, in his own words, he's now just a citizen like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But being inside the Beltway in proximity to Capitol Hill could impact what we hear from President Obama in future years.
Yeah, I didn't actually have time to verify this. I heard somebody mentioning that the last president to stay in D.C. after his term was Woodrow Wilson. That struck me as surprising, but it might be right. It hasn't been the typical thing to do. Presidents move around. I don't know where Bill Clinton, I guess he lives in New York, but I think he spends a lot of time on the road still. But if he's living in D.C., because he's got a daughter in high school I'm a military brat. I moved right before my senior year in high school. So whatever else I can say, I would sympathize with the idea that you shouldn't move someone in the middle of high school. But that, that does put him right in the mix. He's just, it's just harder to sort of fade into the background when you're still in the city where all the decisions are being made.
Sure, that's understandable. Yes, absolutely. Well, let's hear from you. 800-642-1234. What struck you in President Obama's speech? Give us a call. 800-642-1234. Let's see if we can't go to the phones now. We do have two open lines to hear what you thought of President Obama's speech. 800-642-1234. We're talking with Brian Gaines. He's a political scientist from University of Illinois, exploring the President Obama's speech from Chicago last night. Takeaways from that speech. What were the moments that caused you pause? What moments caused you to applaud or perhaps tune out? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, filling in for Joy here on the Ideas Network. Back after this news from NPR. Stay with us. Takeaways from President Obama's farewell address to the nation. Did you sense a different tone than other speeches over the past 8 years? What stuck out? We're examining the address this hour with political scientist Brian Gaines of the University of Illinois, who studies presidential speeches, past and present. And we want to know how this speech ranked in your mind. What grade would you give the speech and why? Add your voice to the conversation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. You can shoot us an email as well at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to the phones with Barbara from Madison. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I guess my takeaway from the speech, I didn't, as I was hearing your guest say, I wasn't hearing ulterior motives to some of the things he was saying or attacks on Trump. I guess what I was hearing was him putting democracy above politics and for us to start listening to the other side and be less divisive. And I really thought that I just took what he said at face value, and I thought that he was speaking to all Americans. He wants a smooth transition. I thought it was very gracious, and that's what I took away from it. I thought he was trying very hard not to get into the dirty politics that we've had the last few months, and that he's really saying to everybody that we have to work to keep democracy working and start listening to each other and stop attacking each other. So
Barbara heard sincerity, Brian.
Yeah, well, I should say that she's not alone. The callers thus far were mostly impressed by the speech, and I think Obama's sitting in polls right now at something between 50% and 60% approval, and by as he leaves office, he's going to be in the set of presidents with high approval. If you draw the line midway through, you've got presidents like George W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, Harry Truman, who left office. Richard Nixon is the extreme case, with something like 30% approving, and then Bill Clinton, Reagan, and others more closer to 60. And Obama's going to be in that class. A lot of people still have fond feelings about him. They approve of his performance and their that's his job approval, his approval, his personal approval. Do you like him? Is even higher. But I will say it's also very polarized, and this isn't unique to him. Basically, it started with the Clinton years and accelerated in the Bush years. That Republicans and Democrats hear different things from these presidents, and they see them through very partisan lenses. And so I think it's quite true that Obama took part of his time last night to suggest people should try not to do that. And I guess I think. Whether you hear us, the last caller did, that is a very sincere plea, or you're inclined to think, well, too little too late, I haven't heard that from you in your 8 years in office, is again something where Democrats and Republicans are going to react very differently.
Well, thanks, Barbara, for your insight. Glenn from Green Bay. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. I just wanted to speak to Obama's legacy a little bit. You know, he inherited the worst economy that this country has seen in most of our lifetimes, and he was the steady hand that really, you know, you want to talk about making America great again, he put us back in the right direction. And also, you know, anybody who thinks that they're going to repeal Obamacare or basically eliminate access to health insurance to a massive number of people who've now got access to it, including small business owners, self-employed people, I think it's going to have a really negative blowback from history and from the people in the country. But also, you know, he spoke to being active politically and instead of being angry, and I think that's important because if you look at Wisconsin's voter ID. You know, 40% of African Americans in Wisconsin do not have a driver's license, and Scott Walker wiped 40% of African Americans off the voter roll in Wisconsin with his.
Well, I want to stop, Glenn, there for just a moment, getting on to Wisconsin issues as well there. But looking at the Affordable Care Act, this is his legacy and what happens. Everyone sees Obamacare front and center in the headlines. Brian, anything done to it, people are going to notice.
Absolutely. I think it's impossible, and it's folly at this point to be trying to paint the portrait of his legacy in full. I think Obamacare is not going to given that his party didn't hold the presidency and the Republicans control both chambers of Congress, it's just not going to emerge intact as it is now. But whether they can solve some of the key problems that are already evident in the mix of sort of a coercive half of forcing people to buy certain kinds of insurance plans, and then but by doing so allowing the people who previously didn't get insurance to get it, or they overhaul the whole thing and sort of introduce new and worse problems, we don't know. And which of those paths we end up on is going to have a big impact in the long run, how historians look back and say Obama spent his years on healthcare reform and then immediately it was revised, repealed, whatever the outcome is, by his successor.
In the final seconds here, Brian, any wise words that stayed with you that may make it into the history books?
It's a high standard. Not that many presidents deliver many, many speeches, and by and large, most of them are forgotten. I think Obama will be remembered as a very articulate. He delivers a very good speech. He's very smooth, and he has a rather distinctive style. Donald Trump has an even more distinctive style, and a few would describe it as articulate. It resonates well with lots of voters, but it's clipped, and he very deliberately uses a limited vocabulary. I think the contrast will be striking. It will make the people who were very pleased with his speech last night increasingly wistful in the next months ahead as they hear the next president speaking, I think.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
I was a delight to be on. Thank you.
Brian Gaines is a professor at the University of Illinois with appointments in the Department of Political Science and at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. In most cities across the country, so-called community schools are campuses that house services like health clinics and daycare centers that can remove barriers to learning. But Milwaukee is taking a different approach. To improve attendance, graduation, and student achievement, Milwaukee's community schools are turning inward and focusing on getting people to talk to each other. Kyla Calvert-Mason went to see how it's working.
In the hallways of Milwaukee's James Madison High School, you can hear yourself think. And to Gregory Ogunbowale, that sounds like progress. When he became the school's principal 4 years ago, fights broke out regularly in chaotic halls full of students who should have been in class.
We have about 500 students in our cafeteria every morning where they come to school. We're playing our soft music. I'm moving and dancing to it. They're making fun of me. And those kids are not going to fight. When I first got here, I mean, before 9 o'clock, we're talking about 6-7 fights.
Junior Aaliyah Locke says the peace and quiet is the biggest change she's noticed since James Madison became a community school last year.
We still have our little moments where we have fights, but from freshman year, where we had fights almost every day, every week, it's tremendously changed.
She thinks everything started to change when teachers and administrators turned to students for solutions.
Access, like, hey, what goes on? One of the students that dig in the fight, they actually sit down and talk to, like, leadership, VFC. VFC is like a violence-free zone, so we go there and talk to their problems, too.
Talking or communicating more is a big part of what it means to be a community school in Milwaukee. It starts with a meeting that brings students, teachers, parents, staff, and outside partners together to answer questions about what they want to see their school become, what obstacles exist, and how they think the obstacles can be overcome. As the community school coordinator, it's Samantha Garrett's job to find themes in their responses and tease out priorities all those stakeholders can agree on. The three priorities at James Madison now:
communication, programs and partnerships, climate and culture.
Next, she makes sure all of the school's groups, committees, and partners understand the community's goals for the school and are working toward them together.
Conversations happen over here and then conversations happen over there, but then there wasn't anybody to connect the two, but then they were talking about the same types of things, right? So then my job would be to like listen in both of those meetings and say, let's work together to do that.
The campus has after-school tutoring services, a parent resource center, academic programs focused on finance and health career pathways. Some of those resources have been on campus for years, but with everyone communicating, Locke knows about a lot more programs than she did when she came to James Madison as a freshman.
We have more opportunities where we can do stuff to help us with college. There's also other after-school programs. If you want to swim, you can swim. If you want to come and study, you can study here.
Should I do both questions, or should I do either one?
Either one.
Staff are more plugged in, too. As counselor Ellen Makowski helps students with college applications, she says she knows more about what's going on outside her department.
I think before, people were doing a lot of really good things in isolation. And I think now we're finding out more about what other people are doing and how we can support that. You know, like a lot of these kids are out of an English class. They know where the kids are and what they're working on. We'll try to make sure that they, you know, get the work made up.
James Madison is in its second year of operating as a community school and is still ranked on its state report card as fails to meet expectations. Agumbawale says more students and partners are being drawn to the school, but there's still a lot of work to do.
Academically, we're inching up. We're not there. Attendance is improving. We start empowering teachers. Now the kids are here. You can't just look at them anymore.
This is the last year pilot funding from United Way will pay for community school coordinators at the district's 6 community schools. They're partnering with the district to raise money to keep the staff in place and spread what they're learning about what works to other schools around the city. Kyla Calvert-Mason, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is the last year pilot funding from United Way will pay for community school coordinators at the district's 5 community schools. They're partnering with the district to raise money to keep the staff in place and spread what they're learning about what works to other schools around the city. Thank you, Kyla Calvert-Mason, for that report. The Joy Cardine Show is produced by Brianne Chasso, Naija Ellison, and Michelle Good. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we discuss President-elect Trump's first formal news conference since July. Reporters have no shortage of topics to cover, from Russian hacking, intelligence reports, to business conflicts of interest. We'll be bringing you that press conference live in its entirety this morning at 10 o'clock. And then tomorrow at 7, we'll discuss the takeaways. Stay with us through the day.